Yes, I'm going to present this work of mine that I posted some time ago on the archive. And I call it A Theory of Inaccessible Information, where I chose A because it's one of possible one. And in this work, I explored what is written in the subtitles, that is the consequences of seriously accepting that some statement cannot be directly proven or disproven experimentally. Okay, so maybe for now it looks a bit mysterious, this thing, because it's not well specified, but I'm gonna tell you the story of how this idea came out. So the idea is this. So can I talk? Yes. So quantum mechanics is something that we study all the time. And we study it, we try to learn what it teaches us and so on. And one of the main lessons, or at least one of the main lessons that I felt that quantum mechanics was teaching, is that there is something that we cannot experimentally know. So this is coming from many different perspectives. So you can think about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, you can think about it's impossible to measure two things at the same time, and so on. But so this is a lesson that quantum mechanics is teaching us. And the idea is, okay, but let's really believe to this lesson and keep it, take it as a postulate, as something where to start from. And let's see if we can in some way construct all the possible theories that have these things encapsulated inside, that start from this principle. So there is something we cannot experimentally know. So I try to do this exercise and see what come out of this. But in order to start do something like this, so in order to start this talking about something that we cannot experimentally know, what is important is having a way of describing what we know. So a way of describing knowledge. And to do that, I try to start from something that is most basic, so that the easiest thing I can think of, that is just logic or standard logic, and saying that everything we can talk about can be expressed as a statement. So this is again a statement, just for an example. So really everything we can talk about is a statement, or whether I stay silent. And so I express statement in a graphic notation in this way. So I have a circle with a letter inside, is a statement one, is a circle with the S and one inside. And we're gonna study how this statement behaves together. So one may consider many statements. I can talk a lot. I will talk for 1 hour maybe. And I will say statement one, statement two, a lot of statement like this. It's moving, yes. But it's better maybe starting with just two statements and see how they behave, see how they behave with each other, what we can do with them. And here I just state how I'm gonna compose statement, what are the rules that I consider, but a rule that everyone knows is just classical logic. So it's like you see here, this is statement one, statement two, you can just imagine two sentences, whatever sentences you want. And when I write this V letter, I say that this is statement one or statement two. It is a new statement. You can call it statement three. And graphically, I write it like this, statement one, statement two, go up, they go to the statement or. And the same thing for the statement and, goes down, a V like this. And graphically represented like this, and a not statement, so the negation of a statement is represented with this thingy coming out, like a hook. And well, I'm sure everyone knows these things, is able to do logic and see. So for example, one can see that if I have statement one, statement two, or statement two, and this is equal to statement one, or statement two again. So these are sort of the rule of how I expect to compose statement. And this is the playground on where we are going to build our theory. But first, one question that one can ask is, okay, imagine I start really from just two statements, statement one and statement two. How many statements can I build out of from just two fundamental statements? So statement one, statement two. There are infinite statements that I can build. There are just a few, I don't know. So here I put an example, really long, but just this. So I take two random statements and I say in the world there are just these two. You cannot say anything else. That is this, random, completely random. The apple is blue and the dog is red. Statement one, statement two. And I compose them in all the possible way, putting and, or, net, not, or, and so on. And I build all these statements. And you can see that if you add an and, or whatever, you will always end up in one of these again. And graphically, this can be represented in this way. This is called Hasse diagram, where here I put statement one, and here I put statement two. And I remind you this, the law, no? If they go up like this, there is an or. If they go down, there is an and so on. But you see that this graphic, this structure is closed. You cannot go anywhere else. They are all like this. And this is the whole word of a word with just two statements. And they form this structure. So, good.
Is upside down T mean false?
Tautologically. Yes, this upside down T and this T are like set the spatial elements, two spatial elements that are useful for making this algebra closed, no? So everything is go up and down, but you can imagine it like here there is no false or true, no? They are just statements they compose together. Okay. I'm not telling if this statement is true or false. They don't even have the concept of true or false. They are just object, but they compose with and or, and they form a structure. Okay, so for example, you will have the statement 1 is connected to statement 10 by this line, and you can say, okay, statement 9 or statement 10 gives you statement 1. Okay.
Well, why can't I have like the apple is blue, yeah. And I can negate that to be the apple is not blue.
The apple is not blue?
With an or, so I can have the apple is blue or the apple is not blue.
What? And it is this.
Okay.
Okay. So then if you have a statement and you have a denegation, the negation is all the rest. If you take the both together, they are the top. So it's the union of all the possible statements. Okay. So this is the structure that you build just from the algebra statement. But as Chris said, there is some sort of... Anyway, before going there, it's better to think... I show you like these two basic statements, but we will refer to this as atomic statement. And we will think as everything growing from this atomic statement. Instead of thinking of two statements, see how they compose, we will consider this as the basic statement. And composing them with or, you can build all the other statements of the theory. Okay? Good. But as Chris said, there is a notion of true and false. But we have this notion connected with the idea of statement. But true or false, in this case, we will consider it as a label that we attach to statement. So you can see, statement, they compose together in the structure, they form this graph. And then to this element, to each element of this graph, we're going to attach a label. And this label is true or false. This label is true or false, and the assignment of this, of the value of this label, so the assignment of true or false, behave, so is compatible, or is that an admissible assignment, only if it behave, if follow the rule by the truth tables. So for example, these are the truth table. Now I show you graphically what maybe it's easier for the following. You see, you have these sort of simple structures now. Okay, so you're just a triangle structure, like two things and one thing on top. And if you have true and true here, truth tables just tell you, okay, so this must be true also for being an admissible configuration of the graph. This cannot be false, okay? And so this is just, the truth table are just a way of how this truth value propagates into the lattice. You assign truth value to the atomic elements, and this truth value propagates along the lattice, giving a label to every element. And again, I can show you two examples of an admissible assignment, is this one, and of a non-admissible assignment, that is this one, because here you have a problem. So you have B or C is true, but both B and C were assigned false. So this assignment or label TTTTFF is not valid. It's forbidden. Good. So now we know more or less how to talk about statements, how to talk about true or false, and now we want to add something. We want to add the idea that there is something that we cannot experimentally know. And to do this, we just add another label to each statement, that is the label of accessibility. So before you were having the label true, the label false, that you have to put in the structure of all the statements. And now you have another label that is A or N, or purple and green, that distinguish between an accessible statement and a not non-accessible statement. Okay? And the idea behind this differentiation is that the accessible statements are statements that we can formulate, so we can talk about them, but we don't have any way for experimentally checking if they are true or false directly. While non-accessible statements, we can talk about them, but we don't have a direct experimental way to check if they are true or false. But these are just ideas. This is how you should interpret this. But you can just think about it like as a label. And being a label, it needs an accessibility value table, like the truth table, an accessibility value table. In this case, though, we are humble. We don't know how these things work because we're talking about something that we don't know even what it is. So the only thing that we know is that if we have something that is all accessible, that is what we are used to talk, things usually stay accessible if we talk about accessible stuff. And so the only thing we know we can say is that if two statements are accessible, the composition of them must be accessible again. So if I can know the truth value of A and B, I will know for sure the truth value of A or B and A and B or the negation of A. And just to be consistent, the other request that we make is that not the negation of a not accessible is still a not accessible. Otherwise, since you want the negation to be double negation equal to nothing, otherwise here you will have problem. No, because you will have problem. Anyway, again, these are just rules on how this color, just for remind you, like maybe you can help. I chose green for not accessible because it's like the virtual color, the color of the terminal of hackers that they write in this green. So you can to remember this. And the rules move like this. So while for the truth label, you had strict assignment, or black or white, so false, true, they give you something, just one. For the for the accessibility, you have that you can choose. Here, you see you have one green, one purple, one green, one purple, and the element on top can be green or purple. You can choose, we don't know. Both are admissible configurations. And you will see this is an example of an admissible configuration. It's something that you will see later. I just put here a picture. And so, okay, good. So now, this configuration, these truth tables, accessibility tables, all the statements that create this structure, give you sort of a model, give you some rules how to behave. It's an admissible configuration that you can attach to a structure of this kind, but everything seems super free. There is a lot of freedom. You can do stuff, and you want to put some constraint, and also you want to put this idea, we want to integrate in this model, the idea that there is a fundamental limit to what we can know and what we cannot know. Yes.
Before that, can I ask a question? Yes.
Here.
So the one at the very bottom, example that you were saying, it was associated with the apple is blue and the apple is not blue. So it was like tautologically false.
Yeah, but okay. This is false. Okay. False is another, is you can put F here.
Right.
Okay. Instead, here I put colors. Okay, there's no true or false in this case. It's a statement, but they call it absurd statement. So a statement that is sort of telling you nothing. Okay, this is telling you nothing in the sense that it's nothing. This is telling you nothing in the sense that there is everything inside. Okay, and if you don't take that everything is accessible, nothing can be accessible. Okay, so this and this must always be accessible in order to have something accessible inside.
Ah, they are accessible, of course. Okay.
Okay, green is the color of the hacker. Imagine the virtual world. They enter in the virtual world. It's not real. It's fake.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So we want to put this assumption.
Yes. Seems like the accessibility is also sort of can't be taken apart from the true false. Like if you go back,
yeah. There are two labels, but they behave in a different way on the structure of the lattice of statements.
Okay. Right, but it's like, given the success in accessibility model, I know that like the A or B statement has to evaluate the true. Because if A or B is false,
exactly. No. So imagine, yes. Right. And?
That's also like, I'm saying like, the it's not as though the inaccessibility model has nothing to say about the truth. The fact that
Exactly. So, because this is something you want. So you want to imagine that things have a true value, but you cannot know if they are true or false. You want to imagine they have some truth value, okay? Because you want to have the truth value of the things that at the end are going to be accessible, to be coherent, to work together, to be consistent with the structure of the lattice. So you have to have an assignment to everything. And so you want to separate the label of truth, the label of accessibility, and the structure of the algebra of statements.
Sorry, can you explain again why A and B can be accessible while A and C are not accessible?
These are gonna be, we're gonna look at, see that later. Okay. Now, no, but anyway, this is just an admissible configuration. You can play with the rules and try to put purple somewhere else, see how it propagates, see what other admissible configuration you have. This is an admissible configuration of colors for the tables of accessibility that I put before, okay?
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
To make sure I'm following. So you chose to make accessible these two kind of disjoint statements in the middle, right?
This
they
is,
really
okay.
Touch each other.
This is an example, but you will see it better later. So later I'm gonna analyze this, okay? So just, if you want, keep your question.
Okay.
If I don't reply to you before going to the relaxation, there is a relaxation moment, you ask again and I reply.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Okay. Anyway, let's put the assumption that we make. And this assumption is just, it's like, come from the desire of imagining that there is some sort of a resolution that we, or for our knowledge, we cannot know everything. There is sort of a resolution, like what they call epistemic restriction or stuff like that. That is, the assumption is our experimental knowledge is limited to be always uncertain about a fixed number of statement D. So there is a fixed number D that we call the resolution, that is the number of statements that we are to be uncertain of. This means in the language of our model, is that accessible statements are constituted by a minimum number of the inaccessible statements, okay? So you have to imagine that if you want to have, like for example, if D is equal to, okay? D equal to, it means that we can know if A, the statement A or B is true or false, it's accessible, but knowing if A or B is true or false, we will always be uncertain if A or B was true or false, okay? We know that the statement A or B is true, but we don't know anything about if it is A or if it is B. We cannot access it. And graphically, so this of course is something that changed the accessibility tables, but not in a static way, but change with this parameter D. And you can see this in a graphical notation. But for example, here you have, when you have two balls, now two green balls, now they are not mixed like in this case, but they have to be not accessible. So the composition, if D is equal to 3, the composition of just two green balls must give you another green ball. While the composition of 3, again, have this freedom. It can be purple or it can be green, accessible or not accessible. So this principle is just telling you like, look, the accessibility tables were really free. Now we're putting some constraint on these accessibility tables. And this is from the part of labels. If you want to interpret it, is there is a resolution in the knowledge that we can have of things described by this model.
What did TIF stand for again?
Sorry. So this is the theory of inaccessible information.
Say that again?
The title of the paper, Theory of Inaccessible Information.
TIF.
Instead of TII, TIF. OK.
Let me confirm if I understand correctly.
Yeah.
Like D basically gives you the.
Next line. Yeah.
Okay. So it's
no. Let's study the structure imposed by the theorem of sensible information assumption one. Here is a slide. So D give you is the resolution, gives you the level at which you can have the first purple ball. You don't talk about this. The first purple ball starting from here. Okay? So here D is equal to 2. The first purple can be here. You cannot have purple here. It is forbidden, completely forbidden. Only green under this level. Okay? Because D is equal to 2. We chose D is equal to 2. While D, big D, is the dimension of the system, that is the number of atomic statements we have. So you sort of have bidimensional. No? One dimension is this small, and another dimension is this big. Good? This was your question. So we study. So this is a space of two parameters. One parameter is this big D, and the other parameter is the small d. Okay. One is the resolution, and one is the dimension.
Are you going to give examples in quantum theory where this kind of thing is?
Yeah, we're going to arrive at the end. We culminate in quantum theory. Okay. So let's study a bit this two-dimension. Dimension two. This dimension, and this is the resolution. We take resolution equal 1. At level 1, everything is accessible. Everything is accessible. This is a classical model. Everything is accessible. Nothing changed. We know this model already. We just have one label, so it's like if the label was not existent. Okay. And so for D equal 1, we have one rule, that if the resolution is equal to 1, the model is always classical. So it's always everything accessible. Good. D equal 2. The resolution is equal to, and the resolution is equal to the dimension. This is a useless model, completely useless, because all the statements that we can talk about, they are inaccessible. So what are we talking about? It's not experimentally relevant, no? Because the only two experimental are this one, and so does not contain any experimentally relevant information. So it's completely useless. And there is a rule that when the resolution D is equal to the number of atomic statements D, this corresponds always to a useless model. So of course, if we study the system with dimension 2, where we don't learn much. So let's go to dimension 3. Dimension 3, we know that for a solution equal to D, it's useless. For a solution equal to 1, it's classical. What happened for a solution equal to 2? Let's check. We try to put one small accessible element here. Is this configuration compatible or admissible for the rule of inaccessibility? No. Because you see that the negation of A or B is C, but the negation of inaccessible things must be accessible. So this must be purple, but D is equal to, the line is here, purple here, below the line, forbidden. So the structure of this logical statement, accessibility, assumption one, already put some constraints on the kind of model you can study. And this model with three atomic statements is, again, or useless or classical, even though you are allowed to put a resolution equal to. There is some structure, it's nice, no, it's growing something. So we start studying, we go to another dimension, the next dimension, and again, you see the model that you see before, that is the one with dimension 4, that is the first one where you can find something interesting, that is this thing, so a configuration that take admissible, accessible, not accessible stuff in the same graph, and you think, wow, I found something nice, it's complicated, but actually, this is just a sort of an inflation of a classical model. So you have this classical model to a binary statement, so or A or not A. And you just sort of put a lot of inaccessible things in the middle to make it look complicated, but it's actually not saying anything. You're just talking about that. Okay, and you can see, so in this case, the structure is, let's see, it's really strict in the sense that now if you try to put a purple one, so an accessible statement here, everything, as soon as you try to propagate this with the rules, everything becomes accessible again. Accessible again. So you cannot really change anything. This is the only, apart, of course, if you change this with these two or with these two, these are the only things with this resolution. Okay. So.
I'm sitting in it.
Okay. No.
This one actually.
Yeah, what was it?
Can you go back one slide?
This or the one before?
So you said over here that C is somehow the negation of A or B.
Yes.
How do you see that?
That C is the negation of AB, because the negation plus one feed or itself must give you total, and A or B or C is this. So one thing to see that the negation is this, you can say that one thing or its negation must gives you everything, and this A or B or C gives you A or B or C. Okay.
So can you run through again once more the argument as to why this diagram fails? Or?
This diagram fails because now you put, for D1 is classical, everything is accessible. D3 is useless, everything is inaccessible. D2 is the only possibility we have. So we choose randomly this purple. We put this purple and we say, okay, this is purple, but is this inadmissible? No, because this purple implies that its negation must be purple too. Okay, because the negation of inaccessible things must be accessible too. Okay, and since C is below the line, so if this is accessible, this means that D must be 1.
Okay,
so in that case, everything becomes accessible again, and this is a classical model. So you can play with structure, but you can see something is emerging. There are some structure growing, and even though everything is so like this, and playing with this sort of trickery again, like this, the negation becomes this, and so on, you can find nice stuff.
So do you call one of these compatible colorings ATIF? Is that what?
No, it's a configuration. I call it configuration of it. So a TIF, I don't know what it is. It's like a TIF is what I will find at the end of the presentation.
Okay. Okay.
For now, it's just So
you call this guy.
This is just but I don't know. We call it husband. I don't know. I don't know. We call it something. Wait. Yes.
So in the case of big D 3, which is this one that you said it's useless, if I say that small d equals 1, why does everything need to go purple?
What if you say that?
So this one in the middle. Why is this not allowed for small d equals 1?
For small d equal 1, for the solution equal 1, is allowed. But everything will be purple.
Why everything will be purple? Why can't you have some, like, A and B being green while C is purple?
You can have this mixture of things, okay? But the fact of the resolution is that you would like to have the maximum amount of things at that level accessible, okay? So otherwise, you have this sort of mixed model that you can always remix to a bigger model with a... I will show you another slide at the end, because you can do sort... When you have things that are asymmetric, you can do a remixing. And then you have just a bigger model with some that is not working very well.
Okay.
Sorry, I thought I understood it, but now
yes.
I understand it.
Yes.
So why... I think Ellie asked the same question, but I kind of don't get it. So A, in the D equals 2, the middle graph, there's A or B, a purple node.
Yes, this one.
A or B, and this is node, right?
This is accessible, yes.
Okay. And then...
Now you take, what is the negation of this? Is this, is C.
Is the negation of A or B, C?
A or A, because, well, you have take this statement, okay? This statement plus its negation gives you this, okay? One statement plus its negation gives you everything.
Okay.
This A or B, this is C. A or B or C is A or B or C, that is this one.
Okay.
Okay? So this statement plus this statement gives you this.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Plus, of course, you don't want to have intersection, and so on. It's a bit more complicated, because you can also say, okay, but also this can be the negation because they gives you this, but they have an intersection.
Uh-huh.
So you see that this one is the negation, is gives you everything, but also the only intersection is this element. So no intersection, and below and on top, they give you everything. But it just, or you can play with this and you can see that if you just use the rules of A or B or C, you take negation and you check.
But wait, so A or B is true?
Yes.
Are you saying C has to be false?
Yes.
In a world of only three atoms.
Yes. Yeah. Where there are just these things, there cannot be anything else.
Why can I not have A or B is true and C?
So when you have these sort of things, you have to imagine that out of the all the elements on this line that I put here, only one can be true. Only one. There is always this rule. Only one of these can be true.
I really didn't say this before.
Because I told you, I don't explain all the rules of how these things works, all the logic and so on, but because you have to play, you have to do A or B or C and stuff.
And why is only one of them not be true?
Yeah?
Why can only one thing on the line be true?
Because otherwise, well, what happens when you put two things is that they sort of identify with each other. Can I show you later?
Okay.
Anyway.
Here you're assuming the number of atomic elements accessible equation. I mean, you're fixing the number of atomic elements.
Each of these graphs is a word, no?
What if the number of atomic elements itself is inaccessible.
And then you have to create one of these plots with this statement expressing the number of atomic statement, okay. And then try to see how it works. Okay, but for now I wear these two parameters, one. Good. So these are some examples that I show, and there are all these trickeries that you put air on, not, yes, resolution, also the negation doesn't work, and so on. And you can find some nice rules. So for example, one nice rule that you find with this logical model is that every classical model with dimension D, big D, inflates to an inaccessible information model with dimension D to the power of 2, so D squared. And you saw an example in this case. Okay. This is just a rule that is, I remember when I was looking at these things, it's like the basis of Hilbert space, the dimension, D squared, matrices, all these things. Anyway, more or less, now you should know about logical lattices. These are logical lattices, true or false, nothing else. Okay? So now let's relax a bit, and relax in the sense of relaxing logic, the hard logic, into something more relaxed. And this is, so did I solve your question before?
You did not.
Okay.
It's very nice. You walked us into the four-atom world mm-hmm. by talking about what you could just generate out of two statements.
Yes.
So that means you've already shown us that if you colored those two purple, the whole thing has to be purple.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Wait a minute. Right. Sorry. In this case, right?
Right. If you color two right next to each other, purple.
Yes.
S2, and the whole thing
yes.
is purple. Cool.
You can say two things. Or if you color two, it's not admissible. Or you color two and you see how this propagates and everything becomes purple.
Okay.
But you can also say no, it's not admissible. I stop here. And then you can say, okay, no, the accessibility tables are sort of dynamical rules. I see how it propagates. Okay.
I'm not following what you're saying, but
no,
please.
No, I mean, imagine I have a test in school and I tell you, put a cross next to the graph that are admissible. You put a cross next to this, but if I give you a purple one here, you don't put a cross because it's not admissible. Okay, it's just not compatible with the rules of the things.
Well, we'll have to talk more later, but it is true if you made S1 and S2 purple,
yes.
The whole thing is purple.
Wait. Yes, if you want to have these two purple, the only compatible
yes.
things is everything is purple.
Yes. Okay. I'm assuming you're still being logical about how you move around.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So, finally, let's relax a bit. And we go from logic to quasi-probability. So this is This is I don't put any kind of detail because it's a long derivation, but there is some history behind it, and stories are easier to understand than mathematics. So the story of this is there was this guy, Cox. Let's say, okay, probability theory is a theory that was invented a long time ago when no one understands it. You can formalize in different ways, but I want to derive it from some logical principle, okay, like an extension of logic. And he has seen that you can just take the statement, the logic, so true, false, and or not, you relax, you have some sort of concept of relaxation, and you see that doing some procedure, you derive exactly probability theory. Like, you don't assume it, you don't postulate, you don't put any axiom, you just derive it. This guy did it some long time ago. The best presentation of this derivation is inside of the Book of James, where he derived exactly, he started from logic statements, he do some things, and he derived exactly probability theory. And also in some new work of Nutt that are more connected with the idea of these Hasse diagrams and statements and so on. And they derive exactly probability theory. It's incredible, just from logic. But here I'm saying that I derive quasi-probability models. Okay? So there is a difference between their derivation and the derivation that I do. So for example, how do I start? The most useful presentation of this derivation of probability is from in this context is the one of Nutt that is asking for an assignment of a value between 0 and 1 and so on to this element of this compatible with the structure of the lattice. So the only thing that you want is that instead of having like sort of a truth table, so an assignment or of truth to each element, you want an assignment of a number to each element, and this assignment must be compatible to the structure of this graph. And if you ask for it, you obtain probability theory. So this will become a probability vector, and every element is going to become like this is the probability of C plus probability of D, and so on. But this guy, Nutt, asked for this number to be assigned to be between 0 and 1 without any kind of reason. So you just remove that. You take the most general assignment and you obtain quasi-probability, okay? Say like that, it seems like, okay, it's a generalization. Why you're just removing 0 and 1, of course you obtain quasi-probability. But then you can take the most serious proof, the one of James, and you see that James, in his their derivation, ask for the compatibility with logic plus the compatibility with something that he calls common sense. We remove the common sense. We just ask for compatibility with logic. So, and again, I stress, compatibility with logic means compatibility with the structure of this graph. And if you remove this common sense, you obtain a theory of quasi-probability. Theory of quasi-probability means only that you, instead of having a probability vector, you have a quasi-probability vector that are vectors of number that sums to one, but they can be negative. Okay? So, now usually two questions can arise. One, if you start for, well, this is what we're going to think later, but what is this common sense of James? James was putting this common sense I didn't mention. It's sort of, it's a bit complicated how you write it, but it's sort of the idea that you cannot have negative interference between probabilities thing. So you cannot have something that sums to zero. Okay? And of course, you obtain only positive things when you remove negative interference. We don't remove it because we are accustomed to quantum mechanics, so negative interference is like, well, it's normal. And so you derive quasi-probability theory. Okay. In the paper, you can find this. Now I'm really talking like this, but in the paper, it's explained, well, it starts from principle, it constructs the equations, you use all these functional equation methods that this guy used. So it should work nicely. Okay. The only thing you must know now is now you don't have true or false anymore. Now you have to each element here, A, B, C, the atomic elements, you associate a quasi-probability vector, a vector of element, real element, that sum to one. That's it. And we didn't assume, we didn't assume probability. We derived it from the structure of the statement. Here I show you a bit of rules if you're, well, sum to one, they so the probability of this is one because it's the probability of everything. This probability is zero. Everything is in R, they sum to one. Then you have some sort of composition. So for example, A or B, they don't intersect. So this probability is just the probability of A plus the probability of B, and so on. Good. And the idea of having quasi-probability is nice because we were talking about something that is not accessible. Things that are not accessible, it's nice to think that they can be described by quasi-probability because there's no reason to assign a probability to something that you cannot access. For every interpretation you have, you can have frequentistic interpretation. You can assign probability to things that you can measure. You have Bayesian interpretation, you have to bet on them. But if it's not accessible, you cannot bet. So still assigning probability to something not accessible, it's weird. So quasi-probability sits really well here.
What was fancy A of fancy S? You had this sum rule.
Fancy?
Yeah, you have the sum over S and fancy. Okay, fancy.
I don't remember anymore, but I think because I just copy pasted from the paper, so I don't remember anymore what
this
was.
Is James.
This is the paper on the archive.
Okay. It's atomic.
I think yeah, atomic. You know, atomic statement. Yes, this.
I'll take.
Thank you. Okay. From logic to quasi-probability. So we have this wibbly-wobbly, we arrived here. And we had this problem, this example that was really strict. So we were saying, you add another purple one, and everything gets destroyed. And this actually not telling you anything, because it's just an inflation of this classical model with these inaccessibility things in the middle. So it's completely useless. But when you go to quasi-probability, things are more relaxed. And when things are more relaxed, you can see that you can add here. Okay, so I forgot to say something. You assign quasi-probability. Quasi-probability are assigned to not accessible things. But we add the constraint that on the accessible part of the graph, okay, this quasi-probability is restricted to be a probability. So you have in general quasi-probability assignment. But on the part that are accessible, you restrict the quasi probability to just only be probability. Okay.
Between 0 and 1.
Yes. Yes. If you add the constraint to each element to be 0 and 1, you have probability. Because the rules are the same and sum to 1, so you have probability. When you do this, you can imagine now let's think that even this element is accessible, and even this and even this and even this are accessible. Does this requirement make everything purple again? No. In this case, we are more relaxed. So you can have, at this level of resolution, so resolution 2, everything to be accessible, everything accessible, without constraining, without pushing, without forcing the whole set of statements to be accessible. So in this case, when you relax, you can have this kind of structure. Inaccessible, so a layer of statement that you cannot have access to, and then a layer of statement that you can access to that are based on the union of this inaccessible statement. That is really encoding the idea of inaccessibility. But here there is another problem. Quasi-probability is a subset of quasi-probability. That means I tell you, okay, this is inaccessible, so this is a quasi-probability. But if I give you a vector 1, 0, 0, it's again a quasi-probability. So it doesn't really tell you the difference clearly between accessible and inaccessible. And for this, we have to refer to assumption 1. Again, with this idea that our experimental knowledge is limited to be always uncertain about a fixed number of statements. And we call this resolution of this model. Again, I just restated what I said before, but the idea is that resolution means that we're always uncertain about a number of statements. So in this case, again, always uncertain means, okay, I know this. If resolution is 2, so we are at this level, I have to be always uncertain about two things. So if this has probability 1, this must always be one half and one half, in order that I know this for sure, but I cannot know anything between if it's A or B. It's uncertain, it's inaccessible. They are the same thing for me, A or B. And here I show you the example with one half, but we are quasi-probability, we have a whole set, we are real numbers. We have to find a measure for this kind of inaccessibility or this kind of, yes, inaccessibility that we have. And to do this, we derive this accessibility measure. This is the last thing we do in this presentation. And then it's the final things, so it's the last effort. So we have to talk about this inaccessibility measure. We want to measure how many things are inaccessible. And here I put two examples. So if the probability of atomic statement is, for example, 1/d, 1/d, blah, 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 it means that we cannot distinguish between d elements. So there are d inaccessible statements because we cannot distinguish them. And so we want this measure to be equal to d. Same case if we have one half, we have two statements that we cannot distinguish. We have uncertainty on two. It's inaccessible, the information between these two. So we want the inaccessible information to measure two on this vector. Okay, so now we're going to restrict again to probability, because in order to build mathematical tools, you need to build on strong foundations. So on something that you know and that you have intuition with, or at least I have to do it like this because I'm not, it's better to be sure. So I just ask, we want to find this measure, the inaccessibility, and we ask for these things. The first thing is counting request. So as I said, if a vector is complete uncertainty over d elements, we want inaccessibility to measure d, and so on for smaller dimension. Then we want symmetry. So if you permute everything, you don't care. Then you want, of course, monotonicity, that is sort of similar to this, but you want this to decrease slowly. But this is the main request, the most important request for the inaccessibility measure, that is multiplicativity. Multiplicativity means that, imagine you have a system where you have uncertainty over 5 elements and a system where you have uncertainty over 2 elements. When you mix them together, you must have uncertainty over 10 elements, not over 7, for example. So you want to ask for this property, multiplicativity. This is also a property that distinguishes this measure from entropies, because it is multiplicative. We impose this ansatz because when you have requests and you want to find something, you look at the mathematician works and you find the most general ansatz that works. We impose this ansatz and we find that there is only one family of inaccessibility measures, so of measures with this property, that are this one. Okay, so again, we are on probability.
Can I ask a question?
Who is talking?
Yes. It's Rob.
Yes, yes.
Can you go back a slide? Can you go back a slide? So I'm trying to understand the multiplicativity constraint.
Yes.
So if your chi function is zero, so that means accessible.
No. One means accessible.
One means accessible.
You have two.
Okay. Maybe tell me what's the range of possible values for chi?
From one.
Because from one
to
one
d.
Is accessible.
From one to d.
And so multiplicativity, if p is accessible and q is maximally inaccessible, then it's one times d.
Yes.
And the overall accessibility is d. So I guess it has to do with the fact that you're choosing accessibility to be measured by one, that's multiplicative. If I was, I could take logs and then multiplicativity would become additivity, where I'd want like zero.
Exactly.
Okay.
In fact, this is sort of, you can think like the most simple example of inaccessibility measure is the exponential of the Shannon Shannon entropy. Oh, something like that. And you can you can see it
if
from.
If I take the exponential of the Shannon entropy, it's going to be multiplicative. Is that what you're saying?
I guess so. No, not Shannon. Sorry, because there are all these family. Now you can see from the next slide, from the result here, these are. Mm-hmm. I don't remember like Reni entropy log of Reni. I don't remember what is it, but if you write it down, they are just entropies.
Right.
Because here I wrote it in this horrible form with a square root. But if you write it properly, uh-huh. you see that there are sort of Renyi entropy, and you can see. So again, these are probability vectors, just for probabilities. And you have this family parameterized by C. C must be different from 1. In that case, I remember there was like a connection. I wrote it in the paper. There is a connection with entropies taking logarithmic or exponential. I don't remember. So these are really the same things, more or less.
And you're saying this chi C that you have on the slide, that actually satisfies the multiplicative property?
This, yes.
OK.
So this is the whole family.
Okay, that's not obvious.
Yeah, yeah, because I wrote it badly, I think, with this square root like this.
Because usually the entropies, you know, they're additive.
Yes.
But not all entropies are additive. So somehow
yeah, they can be subadditive. They can have other things, no?
Right. So you're essentially turning an entropic additive measure into a multiplicative measure. So
yes.
You're looking at a specific entropy that's additive. Is that the idea?
Well, with the proof I used, there were some guys that were putting sort of similar requests, and they obtained this. There are these I don't remember. It's connected with this Cauchy functional equation, I think. No, I don't remember. I don't remember. It's written in the paper. It's really short proof also, because it's mainly done by someone else.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, good. So these are the only families parameterized by this C.
Oh, wait, can I ask?
Yes.
I'm a bit confused. So yes. Why the exponential channel entropy doesn't work?
No, it works. It works, I think so.
So this equals to, I mean, this includes exponential.
Yeah, I think it was for C equal 1. When you go to the limit, you get Shannon, the exponential of Shannon.
Okay.
I'm not sure, but I remember that if you take the limit of C equal 1, this is not possible. You take the limit, you go to the exponential of Shannon.
This linear combination doesn't give you the new measure.
Which linear combination?
The linear combination of this inaccessibility measure doesn't give you the...
No, because it's multiplicative in linear... I don't know what come out if you take a linear combination of this. But it's, imagine, you just at the end, you just take... how you solve this, you just use the exponential map on something, and you move from one space to another, and you can do. I'm sorry, but I don't really remember what I wrote in the proof. Anyway, these are some examples. I show you lean accessibility with number 2 here, with C equal 2 of all these things. So for example, for 1/2, 1/2, you have 2. For 1/2, 1/2, and 0, you have 2, and so on. So for permutation, for this, you have 3. But for this case, where you have 1/3 and 2/3, but it's a bit of weird case, you also have a number that is 9/5, okay? But again, we're talking about probability here, and we would like to have it for quasi-probability, because this is what we are talking about. And luckily, here I just represent it like this. If you do this, so you sort of continue this measure in the space of quasi-probabilities, but not the whole space of quasi-probabilities, because in that case will be, I don't even know how to do it. But in the space of quasi-probability that are constrained to be quasi-probability of the theory of inaccessible information, that is quasi-probability that are constrained to be probability on accessible statements, then on this specific state where there is also the structure of the statement and so on, when you continue this measure in the space of this constrained quasi-probability, there is one unique measure of inaccessibility, that is this one. And so now we have all the tools, because we can, this uniqueness is important, so we don't have any problem in chain one. Maybe you can change, and no, it's unique. And we have all our tools, and we can recast assumption one, saying, okay, now it's clear. Assumption one can be recast as asking for the inaccessibility of the quasi-probability vector to be lower bounded by resolution D. So there must be at least D inaccessible state. The inaccessibility is D is equal to asking for key to be bigger or equal than D. And here I show you some examples. So for example, this vector is not admissible because the inaccessibility is 9/5. And this vector is admissible because accessibility is 2. And these are the constraints. Okay. Anyway, I show you even some more examples just to show some weird vectors. So there are these two first that you know. But then this is also something with inaccessibility is equal to 2. And this is also something with inaccessibility equal to. So in the classical case, if you consider it to be classical, these are the only. Is it not selected?
Are those irrational numbers? Do you know?
They come out from Mathematica, so I doubt so.
Okay. Are they solutions to algebraic equations?
A solution to this.
Equals like a polynomial.
Equal to. This equal to with four elements. Oh. Yeah. But it's just a sphere. Eh? It's nothing special.
So
it's a sphere.
Yeah. Square root of 2. Yeah.
No, no, it's square root of 2?
So that's basically like...
Yes. But it's a sphere. Yeah, exactly. So, okay, there are some examples. And here I show you. So let's see what is this. So it's almost finished, so it's well done.
Oh, before going on, what is the reason we only allow the chi 2 for the question probability in contrast?
Chi with C equal 2 or chi...
Chi C equals 2.
So, we obtain all this chi with different C, mm-hmm. But then you want to, this is the lemma say for probability vector, yeah. Probability. Mm-hmm. Now you want to continue this function over the set of quasi probability admissible in the theory of inaccessible information. And there is just one measure, one C that is equal to 2.
Yeah.
That is this one.
What is the reason?
So it's written in the paper also this, but the idea is this one. So how do you continue this on the set? Let's see if I have a plot. You have this, no? You want to find the inaccessibility of this. Okay. Now suppose this is a probability vector, so it's probability, no quasi probability. In this case, you can compute the inaccessibility because it is a probability vector. Okay, but the constraint set of probability or quasi probability of inaccessible information has the property that this is always a probability. Okay, because these are accessible. Okay, and there is a one-to-one mapping from this and this. So now you can define a function of the inaccessibility of this element that gives you exactly the accessibility of this. When you define this function, now you can put this wherever you want in the quasi-probability. This will always be probability. You have this function mapping down. So you define the inaccessibility through this function. Okay? And when you do this, you see that there is a hierarchy of key, one on top of the other, and telling you, like, for example, key equal 3 depends from key equal 2. Key with C equal 4 depends from key with C equal 3 and depends on key with C equal 2, okay? So you just remove, you want to have the pure one and you obtain the only one that is C equal 2, okay? This is sort of a scheme of a proof of how to extend it. And this is how you see also why it's important that we extend it on the set of quasi-probability compatible with this, because it's the only way that you have this function going down. I don't know if I was clear or not. Last thing, so the resolution equal 2, dimension equal 4. We want to study what are the possible, all the possible distribution Q1, Q2, Q3, Q4 compatible with this theory. And we have first constraint, quasi-probability. Second constraint, inaccessibility equal bigger or equal than 2, and the accessible statement to be probability. These two, for this dimension, become one single thing, and they become only these two constraints. These two constraints, you can see, this is an hyperplane in dimension 4. This is a hyperbole in dimension 4. Where they intersect, in a ball in dimension 3. That looks a lot like the Bloch sphere. This looks a lot like the Bloch sphere because I got it from Wikipedia, from Bloch sphere page. But it looks like a Bloch sphere because you can see the qubit can be thought as a simple model of this inaccessible information where you have the inaccessible statement that are these combined quantities and these that are the spins. Okay, so this is cute. And yes, so even I think that this maybe can help you also understand what I said before because you're used to this, to the qubit, no? So these are inaccessible because you cannot measure x and z at the same time. And there are all of these statements. But when you compose them together, you obtain, again, accessible statements. You can see why also this is the negation of this one, because x up, x down. You can see also why these are not accessible again, because you are composing things weirdly. And so, again, you have the qubit. Nice. And yeah, so the idea is this one. Also, just for dimension two, where you don't have the other constraint of accessibility of things, for the higher dimension, things become much more complicated. You have that this constraint, this comes from the lattice properties, so only from the property of statements to be when you relax to logic and so on. And this comes from assumption one, that is the idea that there is this sort of limit on the knowledge. And these two are exactly these two constraints on quantum, that are trace of rho equal 1, and the purity, that is this mysterious object, be smaller or equal than 1. So there is a 1-1-to-1 mapping. So this theory, these inaccessible things, describe the qubit really well. And as a last question, one can think, this is the last slide, quantum as constrained probability or probability as constrained quantum. In this picture, we immerse ourselves in just the set of quasi-probability. So we go in this set of dimension 4. And we see that adding one constraint of one kind, we obtain probability theory. So we obtain this set. Adding one constraint on the other kind, that is the inaccessibility, you obtain the theory of inaccessible information, that is this set. And they are not one inside of the other. They are just two different sets, but they intersect somewhere. And they intersect in a space of this that contains the set of probabilities that is smaller. And that is a sort of, how do you say? There is some freedom in this set. So if you want to interpret as P2. In quantum mechanics, you can say, OK, I have the set of qubit. I have the qubit. I go to probability. The probability comes from the diagonal that states that are diagonal, but there is freedom in this choice of basis because you can go one base or another one, so you have more probability theory associated. In this case, you see that this freedom comes from the fact that you have a coarse graining to have probability, so you can choose the different coarse graining in this intersection and you have this. So even in this case, you can see that the probability, the classical part of a qubit can be associated with a coarse graining of a probability equal 4, or a quasi-probability constrained by the theory of inaccessible information of t equal of on dimension 4 again, where the freedom comes from this coarse graining procedure that you can choose as you want. And it is finished.
Any questions?
I have some comments, so maybe I'll wait.
So if you want to end later, I can tell you where I'm going, because you can see this, and I will tell you later. Yes. Yes, go. Go.
Is this, can you understand this as a kind of hidden variable theory at all? Because there's like...
What?
Can you understand this as a hidden variable theory of quantum?
So when I put this paper out, there was this guy, Lorenzo Catani, that worked with Rob, and said that I never really checked seriously about this. So I agree, but I cannot be sure 100% because are still looking into these kind of things. The logical part, the, before relaxing to quasi-probability, is really connected, or it's the same, or it's the, sort of the same thing, of the toy model of Rob Speckens. Okay. And then there is this, I departed from this part with Jaynes, so with quasi-probability and stuff. But with hidden variable, I don't know what you're talking about, because hidden variables are like different things. So I don't know, like you have two qubits, I don't know, or you can, there are even other models with hidden variables. For example, in the case of two qubits, hidden variable, they're hidden, but they are accessible in a sense, because they are described by probability. Probability describes only things that are accessible, okay? Whatever interpretation you take, probability talks about things you can measure, or you can bet on it, but you cannot bet on unicorns. You have to bet on something that you can gain money, okay? So that hidden variables are not these hidden variables. That are sort of hidden, but they are not this much hidden, okay? And then you can imagine other theories where there are sort of hidden variables that are hidden degree of freedom, so this sort of epistemological restriction or sort of stuff like that. And I guess it's, I mean, at the end, the idea is always the same, no? There are infinite derivation of the qubit, you can put this postulate of this other one, every time there is something that you know you cannot know, and there's, at the end, everyone is always talking about the same things, you can just put a sort of view from a different perspective, hoping that it will teach you a small lesson of some kind, but that's it. So yes, I don't know which hidden variable you're referring to.
Me neither.
But, okay. Okay.
But can I just add one thing? So
yeah.
Am I understanding correctly that like in this theory that you set up, there exist like not classical bits, but like there exist classical probabilities, but because you don't have access to some of them, it becomes effectively a qubit for that.
Yes. Yes.
Person. Okay.
Yes.
So there's okay. So there's something hidden. Maybe you don't call it hidden. Right?
There's something hidden in the sense that you can talk about something, but you cannot measure it. You cannot have direct experimental measure of that. Okay. Of course, if you have a qubit, you can construct X and Z at the same time on the paper, but you cannot do it.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. I'm listening.
I have two questions. First one is if I consider a statement as a measurement outcome for some quantum system.
Yes.
Does this accessibility measure reduces to some functional whole-level information?
Some functional of?
Whole-level information.
I don't know. So no, but you're right. You can really think about this statement as outcome of measurement. No? One statement is, I receive plus on the screen. That's it. You can see if it's true or false, and then you can see probability maybe in case, and that's it.
Yeah, well, there is some quantity which measures accessibility mentioning system given by basically the difference between the Fanaima entropy between before measurement and after measurement.
Okay, yes.
And I was wondering if this kind of accessibility measure is related. Maybe we can discuss that later.
Yeah, but really, the inaccessibility, it seems complicated because I tried to derive it from logical principles, so from something that made sense to me. But really, it's nothing special. I think it is even, you just go on Wikipedia, you check Rennie entropies, and it's something that is almost the same. But the idea is not, I don't think it's like a mathematical tool that's complex. Is just something that it made sense to derive from some ideas, it came out and gives you some intuition of stuff. Okay, but for what you said, we can have a look at it and see, because it's nice. Okay.
And my second question is, could you go back one slide?
Yes.
I want to know what do you mean by coarse graining here?
I'll show you some example here. No, so. Here I have Q, for example, is this one. Okay, in this space you have these vectors of this kind, P and 1 minus P. Okay, yeah, the simplex, so just the line. And you want to have the states inside of the TIF2 that have this form here when constrained. In this case, you constrain these two and these two. Okay, and you take the sum and you have this vector. In this case, you constrain these two and these two and you have this vector. In this case, you constrain these two and these two and you have this other vector. And there are, these are the simplest constraining that you can make, but you can make all of them. And it's
so is this just saying that the different ways of coarse grain corresponds to different ways of permutation?
A different way of permutation, but I guess you can even do some other sort of trickeries. No, you can put like one third, one third, one third. Here you put one, uh-huh. And stuff like that. And yes, so that's it.
My next question?
Yes. Oh. Okay, go, Rob.
Sorry, I can't see who's got their hands up. So, sorry if I interrupted. So first, just a comment. What Lorenzo said is right, that your lattice of propositions is exactly the lattice of propositions about the underlying ontic state for the simplest system in my toy theory, which is sort of the analog of a qubit. So your atomic elements, the lattice, would be the ontic states of a single toy bit. And then your sort of notion that, you know, you can only access the disjunctions of two of those guys, that's analogous to the kind of epistemic restriction that you have in the toy theory.
Mm-hmm.
So where you depart from the toy theory is when you kind of allow these quasi-probability representations rather than just probability distributions over the atomic elements.
Yes.
First comment is just, you should have a look at a paper by Stephen Van Enck from, 2006 or something like that.
Okay.
Papers called The Toy Model for Quantum Mechanics.
Okay.
It's 2007. And basically he's doing something very similar to your project. He starts with, you know, the picture of the toy theory, but then sort of allows more general quasi-probability representations, allows probabilities to go to negative, and, you know, shows that you can get quantum phenomenology like Bell inequality violations and things like that. And his, the axiom that he derives it from also looks a lot like yours. He's basically using a particular sure convex function as a measure of predictability, which is probably related to your measure of accessibility.
Okay.
So my guess is that there's going to be some overlap between his work and what you're doing.
Okay,
so on to my question. The question is kind of like where this project fits in terms of its philosophy of science. Like, it's, you know, where does it fit between sort of a realist and a totally empiricist approach? So on the one hand, it seems a very kind of operationalist or empiricist project, because you're stipulating that we only need to require that probabilities stay positive when we're talking about propositions that can be tested experimentally.
Yes.
And that sounds very much like, you know, the verificationist principle of the logical positivists, where they say something like, look, the only statements that are meaningful in science are those that can be tested experimentally.
Yes.
And statements about, you know, unobservables, well, they're meaningless, we're not going to talk about them. So you're kind of taking that line.
Yes.
On the other hand, the fact that you're introducing a lattice with finer elements in it than the ones that are accessible feels much more in line with a realist approach. Like in my toy theory, you're saying, oh, there is some reality there. I don't know it, but it's still meaningful to talk about it. And I can ask questions like, in an ensemble of similar preparations, what fraction of them have ontic state A? What fraction have ontic state B?
Yes, yes.
So in a realist approach, you would want those probabilities to be positive. So in a way, the question would then be, if you really want to go with the empiricist approach, what justifies the use of a lattice with more fine-grained elements than the ones you can access? You know, the positivist would have said, oh, those more fine-grained elements are meaningless, we shouldn't be talking about them. So how do you kind of navigate between those two extremes?
I'm trying to do, try to stay between these two things, because I'm unsure which is the right school, no? The idea is that there are things, but you also need to learn how to talk about things. And in order to learn how to talk about things, you need to find the best language. So on the basis of the language that you are used to talk that you are used to use, like logic, so this structure, you want to admit also your sort of ignorance, and admitting the ignorance sort of force you to use this quasi problem. I don't really have a clear picture of where I stand on this. But it's just, I mean, the idea of using a lattice is just because the main differentiation is things we can talk and we can test, and things we can talk and we cannot test. But the space of things we can talk is huge, and still it behaves classically in a sense. Because I think we think classically, no? I don't know if I explained, but to be honest, I'm not really, yeah. I'm not really clear to myself.
But I am. I guess I am trying to sort of articulate a challenge to your project. So let me try a little bit harder to challenge it. Which is, it seems to me that if we look at the atomic elements, you're basically saying, look, we don't need to innovate the notions of logic to talk about them. Yes. Disjunction and conjunction of the atomic elements, those are going to be considered perfectly meaningful, that there are propositions about disjunctions and conjunctions and negation, and they apply to the atomic elements, yes, the atomic propositions. However, probability theory does not. So there's kind of an inconsistency there. You're saying, okay, I need to go beyond classical probability theory for these atomic elements. But classical logic, oh no, I don't need to go beyond the classical case. And somebody might ask, well, you know, that seems very strange. Why don't you force, you know, that the consistent things would be to say classical logic and classical probability theory both pertain, or neither pertain. What's the merit of this halfway house?
This was the...
You see what I mean?
Yes, I understand. But this was also the reason why at the beginning I started dividing true or false logic from the combination of statements. So instead of seeing them as the same things, as is often done, I detach them. From one side, we have the rule for constructing sentences, and from one other side, we have the label of true or false. Okay, when they are detached, true or false, they behave in their own way, but it's really much the same as logic at the end, because Boolean logic is the true or false of statements, so they're almost combining the same thing. When you detach them, you can talk about statements and rules of talking from one side, and from the other side, you can talk about rules of logic or rules of true or false, because logic at the end is true or false, it's not just algebra statement. And in that case, you can see that the rules of logic must be changed, but the rules of how we talk can stay the same. So we can always construct sentences in the same way.
Okay, so I think maybe you're just, you're using the phrase rules for logic a little bit more specifically than I would. That what you're calling the rules for talking, I see as part of logic. So, you know, like what is,
this is what
induced, what's the structure of disjunction, conjunction, negation, all that. I could talk about all that without ever saying, you know, what kinds of two-valued homomorphisms to the set true and false exist on this lattice. Those are, I guess what your answer to my question is that it sounds to me that you're saying, look, the kind of structure of disjunction, conjunction, negation, that's going to be classical, but where the non-classicality comes into the logic is going to be that we don't demand a two-valued homomorphism from the lattice into the set true and false.
Yes.
And so we have this, you know, just like we have non-classicality over in probability theory by allowing negative probabilities, we have non-classicality in the logic too.
Yes.
By, not and, demanding these.
And it's also the part where I try to avoid going into quantum logic or these other weird things, because you don't want to change the way you talk. You want to keep talking the same way always. You want to change just the minimum that you have to. And so I try to change just true or false in quasi-probability, allowing the structure of sentences to be the same.
Okay, I think I have more clarity on the answer to my second question.
Yes.
I guess I'm still left wondering, just like with Van Encke's project, I was sort of wondering what's the status of these atomic elements if we're not being realists? So, but yeah, we can chat more about that.
Yes,
later.
Yes.
Thanks.
Welcome. Do you have a question?
Just a brief question. So the example you showed had like X and Y measurements and Z measurements.
Yes.
Would it work if you would take some more skewed measurements? Because
no, it's work for MUB. In that case, you have to have MUBs, no?
So you work with measurements that are more skewed, like, because you can span the space of emission operators with a different set of projection operators, they don't have to be X, Y, and Z. But it doesn't work in that case.
It doesn't work. No, they have to have mutually unbiased X, Y, and Z.
Okay.
But it's not that they have to. I mean, they come out like this, no?
Okay.
They come out like this. When you can combine them, you have other things.
So what do you say then to the fact that there are nevertheless experiments you can do where you measure along different, it's inaccessible.
And that is a more difficult question because here, I mean, this is what I'm doing, but it's a bit more complicated. It's like, okay, here, for example, you can see that the possible transformation that you can have that preserve the inaccessibility are on this vector are quasi-stochastic maps because they need to send quasi-probability to quasi-probability. So stochastic maps with elements that can be negative. So just matrices with column that sum to one. But also there must be orthogonal matrices. So you have the intersection between orthogonal matrices and quasi-stochastics. This gives you a set of three free parameters that are exactly the rotations of this set of the element here, no? So like if you rotate the sphere. Okay. So all the possible transformations are exactly all the rotation of this sphere. Okay? And if you want to ask other questions, what you can imagine this here, you can just play with the concepts, but you just say, okay, I'm asking the question, but I'm rotating a bit the things, and I see if you want to put a geometry. Or if you don't want to put a geometry inside of this context, you want to just imagine a combination of this request, accessible request, a combination with the experiment, through again a quasi-probability. And with that, you can compose whatever statement you want here. Okay? Because imagine, for example, you want to measure the spin along whatever direction. You just rotate. This becomes the direction that you want. The other one are constrained to be the other directions, but you don't care because you're interested in measuring this. Okay. So, yes.
A lot of the statements you made about, at least before you put this measure on, I think at least would follow the accessible.
Yes.
Would follow if you had some different set of.
No. Yes. Because I exactly. But I didn't explain all of it. So, at some point you want to also to have. So the structure is a bit more complicated than this. You want to ask, for example, to this model to be maximally expressive, so it gives you as much information as possible, okay? And this constrain this set to work in this way. I mean, this is a bit more mathematical. But the idea is that. For example, when you go to higher dimensions, you see that, for example, here you have each statement here, they intersect with one other, with just one element, okay? In this case, it's super simple because the qubit, but when you go to higher dimension, the Q-treat or whatever, this line becomes much bigger. You have many more statements, and they can intersect in many different other ways. And with other way of intersecting, you can find some trick that allows you to gather more information about the bottom. You want to avoid those tricks. And in order to avoid those tricks, you need to put more constraint. And these constraints sort of push you to have here something that when you map again to the Hilbert space with the frame of Wigner, you always have a mutually unbiased basis. Okay?
Okay, I think that's all we have time for today. So let's thank Jacopo again for a really interesting talk.